I hope that other women feel the same, that you can go and master something.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Identity Unveiled. We are a lifestyle platform that talks about career, beauty, health, and to help support the advancement of Asian American women to the executive ranks. Lakshmi Puri is actually a trailblazing professional tennis athlete, and we were so excited to meet her. She actually works with Pillsbury, a full-service global law firm, and an EIR, or also known as Entrepreneur in Residence, where she's responsible for business, client development, and technology industry verticals. We caught up with Lakshmi in Austin and were immediately intrigued by the story of an Indian woman that went from professional athlete to Wall Street to biz dev to one of the top 100 law firms in the nation. And we felt that this story had to be told. Welcome, Lakshmi.
Thank you so much. It's a great honor for me to be here. And I really enjoyed meeting both of you, Shweta and Diane. So thank you for having me.
So Lakshmi, let's just get right to it. Tell us a little bit about your childhood backstory.
Sure. I mean, like a lot of Indian Americans, my parents came here in the 70s. I was about 3 years old. I have one older brother in the physician wave that happened. And we, you know, we first lived in Chicago, but then we quickly moved to California after a couple of years. My father just wanted us to try things that he couldn't do when he was younger. And a big part of that, excuse me, was sports, because he was such a sports fan. You know, he loved watching tennis when he could. I don't think he had a TV in his house, but he saw it at his uncle's police station. His uncle was a police officer, so he'd go to the station and on the TV once in a while there would be tennis, because there's some history in India with tennis. Of course, it's a big cricket nation, but a couple of other sports also, you know, have a lot of history there. And he thought, wow, maybe my kids could play one day. So when we came to this country, you know, we moved to Merced, California, which is a small farming town in Northern California. And we started taking lessons as a family just to, again, try out the sport. And of course, you know, my brother and I did a ton of other things, other sports, music, things of that nature. And of course, education was always number one, as a lot of the Asian and Indian immigrants know. But there was a coach in Merced that told my dad, hey, I think your daughter has some talent and I think she could do something with it. And I think what was interesting is, you know, my parents were kind of like, well, what does that mean? Because so what, you're good in a sport, you know, in Indian culture, especially for women and girls, it's not really valued. The utility is not really, you know, seen and understood. And again, it was very, you know, my dad was like any other immigrant, very education centric. But the coach kept on bugging him and basically said, look, I think she has some talent. I think you need to, you know, you should try and pursue it. And my dad, the way my dad tells the story is, you know, he basically said, well, what does that mean? And the coach said, well, you need to get out of Merced because it's too small. There's not the infrastructure or competition here. And you need to move to Southern California because that's where the best tennis players are in the country. Mm-hmm. And I actually grew up, we subsequently moved, believe it or not, to a town called Upland and then Claremont, which is home of the Claremont Colleges, for those of you know you out there that are familiar with the colleges. And I started taking tennis lessons and, you know, started playing tournaments and doing well. And I guess the rest is history. But it was really sort of, you know, crazy how that whole sort of scenario happened. My mom ended up getting a residency at USC. So, you know, kind of worked out for the family as well.
Was that hard though, to convince your parents to, you know, emphasize sports, even given the pressures of, you know, Indian parents put on academics? I mean, it sounds like some scout said, hey, this person's got a lot of real talent. And then was it just kind of like a smooth, like, what was that point in transition where, you know, you're this young kid and you're like, hey, you know, yeah, I'm going to start sending my daughter to all these tournaments. I mean, was that a lot of pressure?
Sure. I mean, it was a lot of pressure. I don't think my parents never de-emphasized education because of the sport. And I think maybe over time, it grew too much, frankly, for me, because of course academics are hard, but you know, sports is very hard too. And to excel in both, I think is extremely difficult. It was then, and I think it is today, and maybe even harder today because the competition has gone up so much on both sides. So there was never necessarily an overt kind of like, hey, we're going to push you now in tennis. You know, it was just one of those typical, again, Asian and Indian American things where it's like, well, whatever you do, you better be really good kind of thing. Yeah. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, I think I got a lot, I got away with a lot when I was younger in terms of just being talented physically. And so I didn't practice as much. I never went to an academy. You know, I had a coach, played, maybe took a lesson once a week, played a lot with my brother and his friends, which was great because they were all bigger and stronger than me and really helped me improve. I'm a big fan of girls and boys competing against each other in the development stage, especially. I think it helps both sides for many reasons. And so there wasn't really that much structure per se, right? Yeah. I mean, today you have a society where everything is, I got to send my kid to this. And by age 7, they need to do this. And by age 12, and there's a certain path. Although I think COVID has sort of put that scenario or sort of blown up that scenario a little bit, the linear path. But I think my parents, again, didn't know anything because I don't think they knew until I was a teenager, oh, you can get a college scholarship, right? It just wasn't a known fact in the Indian community. And if nobody cared.
There weren't many Indian people or brown people playing tennis, in the sport at the time. So, yeah.
That's right. And I think, again, education was still very much emphasized and the utility of a sport was not recognized, you know, the confidence building, the team building skills. I mean, all that kind of stuff that American culture knows well and has fostered very well. Nobody really cared. And especially in the 80s for girls. I mean, I got to really hand it to my dad, especially, and my mom as well, for letting me play, because I think Indians have always been talented in sports, but culturally it was not encouraged. And I know, you know, many of my friends that were non-tennis players or just not in sports were good athletes, but they just never, you know, were encouraged. So I think you would have seen a different story. I think with future generations, like my daughter, you know, of course there's a lot more risk taking and, you know, of course we emphasize education still, but there's a lot more of, hey, if you want to try something, whatever it is, sports, dance, music, go for it. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the big difference is our parents didn't have that financial stability when they came here and their sort of primary goal was to make sure we survived, right? And the number one way to do that was education. We, you know, all of us, our generation, we have, because of our parents, been able to sort of build wealth. And so that allows our kids to take more risk if they want. And you know, sometimes I sort of, my daughter and I talk about what are some of the possible things she can do and pursue. I always try to encourage her to do something different because she has that opportunity, not only opportunity, but opportunity to fail, right? And she can do something, try something, and it may not work out. And she can always go back to being sort of the normal course of what the Indian and Asian community has become in terms of professionals, right? And so I think you're gonna see a lot more of that. And consequently, I think you're gonna see a lot more athletes, in other professions in our community.
You know, it's lonely at the top, Lakshmi. And so what I hear is that a lot of what you're saying is really, there are so many areas to really impact your kid at such a young developmental age. Mm-hmm. And actually, Lakshmi, I heard that at age 14, you won the Grand Slams, I believe, and the Orange Bowl beating Monica Seles.
Yeah, it wasn't a Grand Slam. It was a junior tournament called the Orange Bowl. And it is a, you know, very prestigious international junior tournament. I mean, gosh, if I'd win a Grand Slam when I was 14, that would be pretty incredible. But you bring up a good point of being lonely at the top, and especially in a sport like tennis, where it's an individual sport. I remember, and gosh, I don't even know if I let my kid do this, but I remember going to tournaments alone when I was 11, 12 years old. And you would house with the family there that the tournament, knew. And you'd get off the plane and they'd hold up a sign and it would say, you know, Lakshmi, my name or their name. And when I got to the family's house, I had to call my parents collect and, you know, say, hey, I'm here safe. So, my parents were full-time physicians, so they couldn't travel with me as much as, especially to national tournaments, local tournaments, they could. My dad basically drove me everywhere. So it was in that way, it was pretty hard. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it is lonely, I think, to be good at anything, especially in something where you start young. You kind of have to be you know, a little obsessed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can talk about this a lot, but, and especially in a culture where you don't have company, right? And in my era, at least now that you see a ton of Indian athletes, I see a ton of Indian tennis players. It's fantastic. There's a lot of college players. You know, in my era, there were maybe in the country, another three or four.
That's incredible. And so tell us, what made you decide to leave professional tennis to Wall Street?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had sort of an interesting path. I had a lot of success when I was young. You know, I played my first US Open professional when I was a junior, getting to be a junior, coming into be a junior in high school. So, and I grew up in an era where sort of the prodigy was something you saw a lot more than you see today. It's certainly not something you saw a lot, but you know, if you looked at, you look at my contemporaries, Jennifer Capriati, Monica Seles, Steffi Graf, they're all, they were all child prodigies, basically. They all did incredibly well from age, say, 15 on. You know, that's pretty amazing when you look at, you know, these women that have played at such a young age, at such a high level, world-class level. And so, you know, I had played my first US Open when I was 15. And, you know, frankly, I was not mature enough to sort of pursue what they did and do what they did. I just, you know, I think the sort of pressure of education, doing well in education and tennis at the same time at that level just was really too much. You know, to your point earlier, it was crazy, right? I was still sort of expected to do well in school, get the straight A's and all that. And I've always had my eye on Stanford. I mean, growing up in the 80s and 90s, you know, that was a school. If you're a girl tennis player in the United States, that's the school you want to go to. They have the most successful tennis program in the history of NCAA Division I by far. And a lot of great champions that I admired gone there. And, you know, they offered me a full ride. It's kind of hard to say no to that. Of course, there are a lot of other great schools. The Pac-12 really dominated, I think, tennis. And Florida was also excellent, University of Florida at that time. But, you know, my decision to go was really, hey, I wasn't really comfortable turning pro, to be honest. I felt like I was failing at something because I wasn't going to have my education. And I think part of that was a cultural sort of, you know, parameter that I set for myself, right? And we all sort of have those, I think, in our life where we think, oh, I can't do something. I don't feel comfortable doing something because that's not what people expect of me, or I don't want to take that risk. You know, I think that was more of my sort of thought process at the time. I should just go to college. I got into a great college and, you know, hey, what else do I need kind of thing. Mm. So I went to college, and had a pretty good college career. And once that was done, you know, now, okay, I can try tennis. And I don't think I was as good of a tennis player, to be frank, at the end of my college years. I think it's just really hard to juggle. I think now college tennis is a great platform for the professional ranks. Back then, you know, I think it was a little different. And back then what people did is they either turned pro or they went to college. There weren't as many people that played after college. So it was just a little different. So you had to make a choice. And when I, you know, when I decided to just go pro after, it was more of a, hey, I need to try this because if I'm the age I am now, I don't want to look back and say, shoot, I didn't even try it full time. Right. So, I went on the tour for about four and a half years, you know, didn't do as well as I wanted. And, you know, it was a lonely life and I kind of just felt, you know, I didn't know if I could do better than I was doing just because I think, frankly, I was probably burnt out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I missed just being home and I wanted a little more stability. So all those factors also played a role of me going, you know, to business school. And you know, the funny thing there is when I came back, my parents are like, you need to get married or you need to go to grad school. So I said, okay, I'm going to go to grad school. I don't want to get married yet. So I went to grad school. And then from then on, I got a job at, you know, in Wall Street. And, you know, typical to what a lot of people say, a lot of the sort of skill sets and mindsets translate to Wall Street as an athlete, you know, the sort of intense competitiveness, the sort of execution oriented mindset where you just get things done. You know, you fight through things, you work incredibly hard, you have physical stamina, all those things you know, really played a role in sort of not just going into that profession, but also, you know, succeeding and trying to succeed as well.
So today your career is focused on, you know, building relationships to help companies in the technology startup space. And I remember when we met, you said to me that you love talking sports, that you could just talk sports all day. And, you know, one of the reasons that we do this show is to help advance Asian American women onto that executive platform. And so one of the things that, you know, like I remember it was Inder Nuri that said that when she came here into, she had to learn football or learn, I forget which is football or soccer, I can't remember, maybe it's baseball, just so that she could have and relate to the boys' conversation that was taking place at the table. So I'm curious, do you feel like sports has kind of given you that edge in building those relationships at work with other leaders?
Absolutely. You know, frankly, and this has been true my entire sort of career post tennis, the first question I have always gotten on an interview is, wow, you played at the US Open, or wow, you got to play Monica Seles, or whatever it is. And, you know, sports is so revered in this country, right? Culturally revered. And it's been such an integral part of advancement in this country socially. You talk about civil rights, you talk about women's rights, equal pay, the soccer news that just came out where, you know, I think it's the bonus structure will be paid equally now between men and women, which is about time, right? So I think it's a reflection of our society and where we want to be. And it's a great meritocracy. And I think that's why this country loves it so much, because, you know, when someone's winning or when someone wins, you know, that's because, you know, they're good, right? And they perform. So I think that's a huge sort of tenet to this country. People respect performers and people that can find a way to win. But it absolutely does help me. You know, I kind of joke with my firm that everything I talk about, I'll sort of use a sports analogy. And, you know, they know that now pretty much. And I do a lot of events with sports involved, because I think it's just a great way to hang out with people and build relationships and get to know them. You know, incidentally, about a few months ago, I had a chance to talk to the golfer Michelle Wee, who just, I think today announced that she's retiring from golf, and, you know, one of the greatest golfers ever, and was a Stanford grad as well. And, you know, she started this organization that helps underprivileged kids learn golf. And I asked her, why did you start that? And she said, well, you know, if you play golf or if you play tennis and you're a woman, you get a seat at the table. You get to mix, and exactly what Indra Nui said, you get to mix with the executives. You get to be in front of, you know, leadership, right? And it's because you play golf. You know, and she's 100% correct. It does open doors. And again, it's just something that's so culturally revered that it's a very useful tool. Now, I have a huge passion for it, so I can talk about any sport, because I really, what makes it so beautiful to me is the fascination with why is someone good? What makes them good? You know, I can analyze any sport. I just love to watch great athletes. I don't care what sport it is. You know, I'm a huge fan of, say, the Indian field hockey team, because I think they're just beautiful to watch. And that's something that, you know, field hockey in this country is more than half the country doesn't even know what that sport is, right? In this country, at least. But I just have this, you know, huge fascination with the beauty in sports. Mm-hmm. And it is a great conversation maker, you know, remembering plays or watching, you know, surprising athletes come through, like you see this kid Alcaraz now in Spain, that's just crushing everyone on the men's side. So it's just, again, I think a great tool to interact with other people. And you know, if I was in India in the 80s, nobody would have cared except for cricket. And so I encourage especially young girls to participate in sports, you know, not to play in college or to be pro, but just to build those social skills, to build that confidence, to, you know how to work on a team, and to, you know, learn strategy, because in teams you have to have strategy, right? These are all sort of basic building blocks for any career.
What do you feel though has been, because you're in the field of developing relationships. I mean, that's kind of what you're doing day in, day out. So what do you feel has kind of been the biggest challenge in connecting with others?
I mean, I think, you know, by nature, all of us are sort of biased, right, towards certain people. And I'll use women as an example. I think one of the reasons why we haven't gotten to the places where we should be, or it's maybe harder, is frankly, I don't think we give each other business enough. I don't think we evangelize or be advocates for each other enough. And I think we talked about that when I first met you, which is, you know, I've had friends say that are in leadership positions on Wall Street, women that say, you know, the guys hang out after work. Why don't women do that? And of course, a lot of it is because we do have domestic duties that we take, you know, we take upon ourselves or take more seriously and or are just given, right, or expected to do. But you know, I don't think we've gotten to the point where we're not gonna do those things, right? Because we have some guilt around that. And we enjoy it. I mean, I love being a mom. I absolutely love being a mom. It's the greatest thing, 100 times the greatest thing ever in my life. So I think that's part of it. But I also think, you know, my daughter came home the other day and said something interesting. And it's sort of that, you know, theme of the girl of the movie Mean Girls. And she asked me, she goes, why are girls so mean to each other? You know, and I kind of think, you know, and I don't know the answer to that, but I kind of think there's something there about the camaraderie that we don't have as much as I think our counterparts do on the male side. And I think sports is one of those things that can break through that, right? Because I'll tell you, like, my daughter's best friends are, you know, other female athletes or people on her lacrosse team. And I think, you know, she not only respects them and she likes them as people, but I think because they strive towards something together, she feels a camaraderie there. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's hard to achieve. I think that's hard to achieve, especially, you know, with someone different than you. I mean, that's, I think, you know, human nature is you sort of gravitate towards what you're familiar with. And the thing about something like sports or something like music is you already have that shared experience, and it's not necessarily a ethnic or a language, or it's just playing. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think, you know, I hope more women get into sports for that reason, so they can have that camaraderie and they can interact with each other, even though they're from different backgrounds or whatever.
Well, it almost sounds like in some ways sports has kind of superseded your ability to, you know, superseded kind of the race or the gender aspect of the way that you connect and build relationships with others. It's kind of like this universal language, if you will.
That's absolutely. Crazy. I mean, I have men ask me all the time to play, right? And they don't care that I'm a woman. They want to play with someone that's good or someone that, you know, can hit to a certain level, and they could care less. And they look at my ability. Right. And, you know, I think that's a beautiful thing, right? They're not judging me by anything else except, you know, hey, you can do this. And this is a fun way to interact with another human being. And so, you know, and I do think, I mean, I'm sure there's a PhD thesis written about this somewhere, but I do think that, you know, when you look at, you know, cultures where sports is very high up in terms of the respect it has, you probably see a more equitable sort of, you know, society, right? Mm-hmm. Versus countries where sports is not, especially for women, not encouraged or not even thought about.
We haven't even talked about your career, Lakshmi. So, you know, on your LinkedIn, you could see the progression of you always being number one, you being the trailblazer from that tennis player at a young age, consistently performing, as you mentioned, throughout your career. And tell us why you, and I see this big turn into from Wall Street to angel investing. Where were you going with that? And how are you here today as an EIR?
Yeah, you know, I never thought I'd, you know, to be frank, it's one of those things where when you're younger and you're studying something, you're in college and people say, oh, you may angel invest or you may be an EIR in a law firm. I mean, that's certainly not the first thing that popped in my head. I thought I was going to go into medicine like most Indians, and my parents are physicians. My brother's a physician, you know, or law or something, being a lawyer, and I'm not a lawyer at the law firm. I think, you know, for me, I just love learning about new technologies, different companies. You know, the companies I help, they're mostly early stage. So a lot of times investors evaluate those companies based on the people, right? And there's a lot of similarities between great athletes and great entrepreneurs, right? It's that never die attitude that, you know, what I think is the most underrated quality, which is just, you know, intensity, right? And there's another word that I'm looking for and I can't think of it now, but it's just the willingness to do what it takes. And when you see great athletes, like great entrepreneurs, they have that. You know, I just met an entrepreneur the other day that said, you know what? I have a year of money left, but I'm going to die before this company goes under. And it's, you know, you think of athletes because that's exactly what an athlete would think when they're super competitive and they've reached a high level. Because you kind of have to be that way, right? You have to have that tenacity. That's the word I was looking for. You have to have this amazing tenacity to succeed and to get to the world-class level in both areas. And, you know, the angel investing sort of came about haphazardly. I met a few companies just by chance and, you know, got involved with them just because they're friends of friends or whatever. You guys know how that is, you know, and being especially in the Bay Area, you meet so many people that are starting companies or say, hey, I have a friend starting this and this is a great idea. And so it wasn't something that we planned per se. And the opportunity at Pillsbury just came up, you know, about 9 years ago now, just again, by chance, a friend of mine was in the same position and she called me up one day cause she was leaving. She said, hey, they're looking for someone, you'd be great. I think you should interview for this job. And it's been great because I don't do the legal stuff, which because I'm not a lawyer, number one, but I don't think I would enjoy that. I sort of help companies think about their businesses, with their business plans, in certain cases, fundraising. You know, it's hard, but it's fun. And just trying to encourage these entrepreneurs, because again, you know, a lot of them are at that stage. Most of them are at that stage where they're struggling or they're trying to raise money and they need to hustle and it's hard. Right. Mm-hmm. And they oftentimes get discouraged or, you know, they've gotten rejected 10 times in a row and they're like, what do I do? Right. And again, it's very much like an athlete's mindset, right? You got to keep fighting. And if it was that easy, everyone would do it because, you know, most people want to be their own boss and start companies, but it's a hustle.
I love the correlation and I definitely feel that way. I was not a tennis player anywhere. I was in the country club tennis playing on the summers, but I get the competitive part, right? And so, you know, you see a lot of companies, you are the EIR. Tell us how, you know, is there an unspoken bias for women or BIPOC or people of color when it comes to fundraising?
Yeah, I mean, the stats show they are. I mean, I don't have the stats in my head, right? The stats clearly show they are. When you look at who gets funded and who doesn't, right? And it's hard. I mean, you know, I'm trying to think, okay, what's the solution? I think one of them is that, again, the women supporting each other and having more camaraderie from a young age and really, you know, and you see a lot more funds out there targeting specific minority groups, whether it's women or, you know, people of color, whatever it may be, right? And I think that's great because that definitely needs to happen. And it's going to take time, right? It's not going to happen overnight. I think once the machine gets going and it gets bigger and bigger, hopefully in the next 10, 20 years, if my daughter decides to start a company, she won't have as much trouble or, you know, have as much bad luck as someone 15 years or 20 years prior to her, right? You know, cultural change is, I heard that's a Google question that what's the hardest thing to change in a company? And the answer is culture, right? Cultural change is extremely difficult. I mean, you have hundreds of years of history behind it. So as sort of the headwind. And so, but you look to people that have achieved things, you look to, you know, representation in all these markets and hopefully it motivates and inspires others to take risks and to do what, you know, like Indra Nooyi did, right? Mm-hmm. And we'd never seen a CEO that big until we saw Indra Nooyi as an Indian woman, as a traditional Indian woman wearing a sari, you know, having a bindi on her head, which we've seen photos of her. And all of a sudden she's, you know, CEO of, you know, one of the biggest multinational corporations in the world. So you know, seeing that, having my daughter see that, right, that's really important, because then she can say, hey, I can do that. And so, you know, it's tough, but it's worth the fight. And we just have to keep fighting.
How has your Indian heritage influenced how you make choices for yourself and also work with others?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I grew up very conservatively, right? I grew up in a generation, for my parents being first generation, like many, again, Asians and Indian Americans, they tried to maintain that generation of you know, the 60s and the cultural values. So, you know, I grew up fairly conservative. I wasn't allowed to go to dances and do sort of, again, risky, what they perceived as risky, sort of out of the box things, right? And I think sometimes that affects me in positive ways and negative ways, right? Like sometimes I think, oh, should we take a chance on this? You know, what would my parents say, right? And we don't take a chance. But I think one thing that has happened is, you know, my husband is a little more of a risk taker in some areas. And so I think, you know, he's pushed me to do some investing, like in real estate or something, you know, that I probably wouldn't have even thought of 20 years ago. Just because he's like, no, don't you see that, you know, don't you see people have done this? Not everyone is a doctor and an engineer. Okay. And I know that's sort of a very rudimentary, basic example. But, you know, it's taken me to a place where it's like, wow, yeah, I didn't realize that this could be something where you can be really successful and it's okay. And so what, you're not a doctor or an engineer, you know what I mean? Or you're not an internet startup, right? Which I think is also very stereotypical now of sort of the Indians coming into work in the workforce. So I think, again, just being exposed to other people that are successful in whatever it is to say, hey, wow, I didn't know you can be successful in that, right? And you know, I think that's where I think my culture at least played a role in decisions early on. And you know, sometimes I think I made the wrong decision. And I'll give you a concrete example. I did want to be a doctor earlier in my, you know, when I was in my 20s. But one of the things that happened is because I went on tour and I graduated, or I'm sorry, I quit the tour when I was about 25, 26, I thought I was too old, you know? And because, you know, you're an Indian, and by the time you're 26, if you're not finished with your medical school and not doing residency, wait a minute, you're going to do post-bac and then you're going to go to med school. So by the time you're 31, you're going to have your medical degree and then you're not married. And all these thoughts, right? All the Indian women know what I'm talking about. All these thoughts go to your head. And all the sort of Americans are looking at me saying, wait a minute, what are you talking about?
You're only 31.
Yeah, you're only 31. Like, you have the next 40 years to be a doctor, you know, right, or whatever, 35 years. And I look at that timeline and I think, yeah, it was so stupid. That was really stupid. I could have been a doctor easily, right? And it could have worked out. And so I think, you know, and that's a pivotal decision, right? And I've had friends that have quit law or whatever, or engineering, whatever, and said, no, I think I want to be a doctor. So, and they're older and they're doing fabulously. And I think that's the thing. I think, you know, in our Indian culture, much like the Asian culture, our parents laid out a very linear path of how things are supposed to happen. Like, you're going to do this, then you're going to do this, then you're going to get married, then you're going to have kids, and then you're going to have to do X, Y, and Z. And what I've realized, you know, now is in what will be my 50th birthday in November, is life is not like that. It's not linear. I think, you know, the pandemic, certainly all the sort of crazy things happening around us, the war, you know, a lot of headwinds with the economy is really showing that as well. I think the pandemic was a huge thing for that, where, you know, as a typical example, you see all these kids, poor kids that worked so hard to get in these colleges, and they did everything right in that linear fashion, right? They checked off all the boxes, and they're not getting into the schools because of, you know, all these effects of the pandemic, COVID happening, and rolling admissions. And you're seeing it happen in college sports, right? Recruiting is a lot harder. So I think going forward, the best leaders are going to be able to adapt to things like that, because I do think more and more things like that will happen, right? Everyone says, wow, we're likely going to have another pandemic at some point. So we don't know when.
that dives right into my next and actually last question is, you know, you have ingrained with you at such a young age, a competitor, a title holder, and you are an athlete, right? And still today, that athlete turns into incredible qualities that actually the woman out there, they want to know, they're listening. How do you brush things off? Women tend to be really hard on themselves. Yes. But you see entrepreneurs face to face as an EIR, time after time taking hits. How do you handle it?
You know, I personally, and you're absolutely right. I think women and girls, they always feel like they need to be perfect. And certainly I think in our cultures, it's even more prevalent because we are defined by these very specific roles, at least in our generation, right? I hope our daughters grow up differently. And so I think anything outside those boxes or those lines becomes uncomfortable. And, you know, frankly, one of the things I referenced was my immaturity and playing these world-class events when I was so young and I couldn't handle it. And that's one reason why I took failure very hard, you know? And my parents did too, right? And so, because it's like, wow, you spent all this time doing this, you played hours a day and you traveled all these places and all these kinds of things. And then, oh, you failed, you know? It was hard to swallow. And I failed because I wasn't top 10 in the world. Not that I, you know, objectively, oh, you're a loser kind of failure. It was this failure relative to an expectation I had, which in our cultures is always like, you need to be the best, right? And that's what I was saying earlier, is to achieve that in two things is extraordinarily hard. And you're seeing some of the effects that are playing out in society. You see, you know, unfortunately, kids committing suicide, you know, that are extremely high achievers, that just are like, okay, I can't do this anymore. And putting themselves sort of in a box because they think society says you need to do this or you need to be this successful. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you're absolutely right. With women, again, that strive for perfection always, whether it's how you look, you know, how you're performing at your job, a lot of, hey, I need to do twice as good as someone else because otherwise I won't get noticed. You know, those kinds of feelings. It's real. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of women feel like that. And like I said before, I mean, you know, we just got to keep fighting. And it's not going to be an easy sort of short change or quick change. And we have to be evangelists for each other. Again, I don't see that sort of evangelism as much as I'd like to, right? And that, you know, advocacy, that's the word I'm looking for, to say, hey, this person's really good.
So thank you again, Lakshmi, for joining us today and sharing your incredible journey. We are so excited. You have so much wisdom. So check us out again, everyone, on IG, TikTok, LinkedIn, on our website, identityavail.com. And we're so excited to have Lakshmi today. See you next time.